My guest today is Emmett de Monterey, a psychotherapist and author with an extraordinary story.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
My guest today is Emmett de Monterey, a psychotherapist and author with an extraordinary story. At just 18 months old, Emmett was diagnosed with cerebral palsy, and as a child of the 1980s, his diagnosis and subsequent physical challenges were not easily accommodated by the world around him. Case in point, at his school, the staff refused to reschedule his classes to ground floor classrooms, and he was forced to climb stairs at huge effort to attend his lessons. Hope was on the horizon when, age 12, Emmett was chosen for a first-of-its-kind surgery in America. The world's media turned their attention on Emmett and his family and this potential miracle, but it wasn't the fairy tale ending Emmett was expecting. And at sixth form college for disabled students, his sexuality became an issue, and he was even told that if rumors circulating about him that he was gay were true, then he could be expelled. Being able to be authentically himself is something Emmett hasn't always felt able to do, and a huge part of his journey has been reckoning with a world which views disabled people as invisible and unworthy of desire. I always say on this podcast that it's getting to see the world through my guest's eyes that I find so inspiring, and I'm delighted to be learning Emmett's life lessons today on The Emmett Gunn Show. Welcome to the podcast, Emmett. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for that lovely introduction. I'm delighted to be here.
You're so, so welcome. And it's such a fascinating and interesting story. And let's just unpick something there in that you were, 12 years old, the world's media is focused on you. This is like a miracle, game-changing operation that you're going to have. And you kind of, you went viral back when things didn't go viral.
I did. It was a very, very odd situation because I was selected for this surgery, as you say. And because the technology was so unusual, it was a really big story. And you're a journalist yourself. You know about how often the media narrative is different from the reality that is happening. And the surgeons in America were quite surprised by the level of attention. I mean, I was traveling with a documentary crew, news crews, the representatives of the charity that I was a fundraising figurehead for. And the surgeons always said to me that what we're talking about is improvement in your gait, improvement in the way you walk. And, you should be able to walk well into adulthood once we've done this. But the media narrative was that it was this. I remember one headline from the South London Press that said, "Boys, sci-fi bids the walk."
Oh, wow.
And as a 12-year-old who just wanted to be like my friends, I chose to believe the media take on the situation, and the surgeons hadn't misled me at all. So they were quite concerned that I had very different expectations of what was going to be achieved. So it was
So they're trying to be very realistic with you. This is what we're going to do. This is the potential outcome. This is what life will look like on the other side.
Yes.
And the media are spinning it will be a miracle, essentially.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, one of the working titles for the book was Miracle Boy. And I rejected it because I was like, one, it doesn't seem as though it could be seen as ironic, and it felt a bit, it just didn't feel right. But it was a very difficult time. It was a very peculiar, but I should say that the journalist that we traveled with, we're a very small family, we're only three. And the journalist that we traveled with actually became friends and showed me enormous care and friendship and consideration. So it's not really their fault either. It was just the story that they were tasked with telling.
Well, it's like anything, isn't it? They want you, you want the world to think that miracles are possible, and it's a great story. It's much, it's going to sell more papers than Operation Might Work.
Yeah, exactly that. It's just slightly easily digestible, and it's like one of the shows that I was listening to in preparation for coming on and speaking to you today about toxic positivity. And very, very often people prefer a simpler message, don't they? And I remember you said, you know, something about live, laugh, love. And it's like, well, if only it was that easy. And actually, things are a bit more nuanced than that. And most of us find it a lot more complicated.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. I think you're referring to the conversation I had with Whitney Goodman. She was amazing.
Yes,
Sit with Whit on
really
Instagram. I found that conversation really validating for not having a sunny disposition.
Yeah,
it's actually
a bit more realistic, isn't it?
100%.
And actually, sometimes I don't know whether you find this, but if you don't have a sunny disposition all the time, you can sometimes feel like that you're being blamed somehow by our culture, or the onus is on you to be endlessly positive, or, you know, spin situations, which can be very, very difficult, actually.
Yes. Well, listeners, go back and listen to that conversation with Whitney, because it was really interesting. But we've talked about your operation, so it's a really good point at which to come into the conversation. I asked my guests to talk to me about their relationship with risk first off. And I know that specifically your answer is about the operation, deciding to have this operation when you were 12.
Yes.
You had some agency in that. But I wonder now, as a grown man, how you would characterize your relationship with risk and how it was informed by such a big life, potentially life-changing operation at such a young age.
That's really interesting. It's really funny because that temperamentally, I'm very risk averse. You know, I don't know whether it's because of that operation or because of that decision, but having grown up, I'm quite a cautious person. And I like to assess things in quite as much as you ever can. I like to sort of look at things from both sides and try and figure out. But yeah, I mean, I remember when I was, when we as a family were talking about the operation, my mum said, "It's completely up to you. We won't do it if you don't want to do it, because, you know, obviously life in a wheelchair is fine, you know, we can learn to navigate that. You can learn to embrace it. You can, but if you want to do this, then we're behind you 100%. And I'm wondering whether that has actually, it has informed my relationship to risk, because it felt like, physically it felt like something quite difficult to do. Again, I think the risk wasn't just physical, it was about my expectations.
Yes.
So.
But perhaps that was something you only really realised after the fact.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I don't think you can figure out, you can't work out what everything's going to pan out like. You have to sort of take a gamble at certain points and kind of go, well, if I don't do this, then what's life going to look like? And if I do, what's it going to look like? So, it was difficult, and it has made me, I think, much more cautious. And as you said, just slightly more. What was it? Sorry, I've lost my thread a bit. That sort of not having a sunny disposition.
Yeah.
You know, being a bit more realistic about the way things can be.
Do you remember when your family said to you, "We'll support you, whatever decision you make"? Do you remember what your decision-making process was? Can you sort of put yourself back in that position and just thinking,
absolutely,
I just want it?
I've thought about it a lot subsequently, and I thought about it a lot in the context of my own psychotherapy training as well. I really wanted at that age just to be like my friends. You're a child. You just want to be like the people around you. I was very lucky. I had a group of close friends. I was in a mainstream school at that time, and I just wanted to be like my friends so badly. And actually, I would have done anything at that point to try and be like them. I just wanted, I was so aware of the growing distance between myself and the world. I was so aware of my, you know, as people are growing up and they're beginning to kind of experience themselves in a different way, I would watch them playing football and watch them playing rugby. I went to a all-boys public school at that time. So it was very, there was an emphasis on the physical side of life. And I just wanted to be that so badly. So in a sense, even though I did think about it, I was also quite cavalier because my internalized ableism at that point was so pronounced, and I didn't have the language or a way to accept myself as a disabled person because I was the only disabled person at that point that I knew. You know, I was the only one in my school. I was the only one in my friendship group. And I just wanted to be like everybody else so badly that I was prepared to do anything.
It's really, it feels really difficult and perhaps clunky and clumsy to make this, to draw this parallel. But I think at school, and again, this is through my own therapy, you can't really blame kids for bullying you, because I think all kids do is they point out the thing about you that makes you different.
Yes.
That's kind of like the social cohesion of how kids work. So listening to what you're saying, I can completely understand. But I think a lot of people in school go through that experience of the thing that is different about them is the thing they want so much to change. And it makes them feel as though it's why they can't be part of the group or part of the tribe. And it could be, obviously your situation is very, very different. I'm not trying to minimize it, but I have had similar tones of conversations with friends about the fact that you wanted to wear the same clothes as people, or the fact that I was one of a handful of Asian girls in my school meant that that was a point of difference, and I was overweight, that was a point of difference. And so all of the things that you have about you that are different, they feel like these huge barriers, and they put this huge distance between you and being able to have a quote unquote normal life.
Yeah, they're really amplified at that age, aren't they? For whatever reason, they're really, really amplified. And
have you ever been in touch with any of the people that you went to school with and got a sense of what their experience was like? And has that given you any comfort to hear that maybe it wasn't all rosy for them?
Well, really weirdly, the boys' public school that I started my secondary education in, I had a profoundly positive experience of, and I wasn't bullied at all. In a way, I was sort of the school mascot, and I was really well taken care of and really well liked, which I have to say I wasn't expecting. Because it was a very masculine culture, so it was a real surprise to me. It was a pleasant surprise. But when I had to leave that school because the physical demands of the building were so difficult, and the teacher said, well, he's just not going to get the GCSEs that we know he's capable of. When I had to leave that school and go back into special education, the place where society told me I belonged, in this segregated environment, actually, I've never felt more lonely, and I've never had a more difficult time. And it was really unusual, because for those pupils, it was the place where they felt that they belonged the most. And for me, it was the place where I felt I belonged the least. And they had an experience of community that I didn't have. And also, to them, I was the boy who had been on the telly flying to America to get my legs changed, to get my disability changed. So they were quite angry with me about what they saw as a betrayal of my disabled, betrayal is probably too strong a word, but a problematic relationship with my disabled identity. Mm-hmm. And if you add to that the fact that I was quite clearly, realizing that I was gay, then it was a pretty toxic environment to be in.
Did you feel lost then? Did you feel you had belonged and then you didn't, and you didn't know what the future was going to hold?
I sort of it weirdly, I don't know whether this is my own internalized ableism that I had at the time, but I really felt like I belonged more in the more traditional school with my public school peers, and I really was embraced and treated kindly. And also, I have to be honest, at that point, as we've sort of touched on previously, I didn't want to be disabled. So being in a disabled school, it was like looking in a mirror that I couldn't look away from. I finally had to face myself and go, "You don't look like your friends at the other school. You are disabled. You walk with crutches. You do look like this, and this is how life is going to be from here on in." So I kind of had a quite a profound psychological transition of like having to try and accept myself and my body as I was, you know, and that was a parallel with kind of figuring out that I also might be gay.
Did you? It was interesting you're saying there about internalized ableism and you feeling more in common with the friends at the public school than at the specialist school. Was there, do you think actually that that in any way helped you in the long term? The fact that you went to a school where actually, even though you were in the minority, you were treated as an equal. Do you think
Yes.
that, yeah.
Yes. Really, really good question. It made me understand that there were going to be people that would embrace me, and that actually my disability was more of a problem for me than it was for a lot of my friends. You know, and I had a particularly good female friend growing up, and she used to say, I mean, it was very well-meaning, but she used to say, "Oh, but we don't think of you as disabled. You're just like us." And that was it, in at the height of my internalized ableism, that was like music to my ears. But having reflected on it, I now feel, I mean, obviously I'm not criticizing her, she's a lovely person, but having reflected on it, it's like, well, why don't you see me as disabled? Why can't you embrace my disability as part of me? And a meaningful part of me, you know, because it is, you know. So I suppose I've learned to embrace it in a very different way.
I think that touches on a much bigger thing as well about how the vocabulary that we've used around certain things has really changed.
Yes.
And that's a really good point. Back, what would that have been, the late 80s or
Yeah,
early
it was kind of
90s?
late 80s, early 90s.
That would have actually been a very kind and generous thing to say to somebody because the acknowledgement is, well, I know that there's something that potentially works against you in life. But I don't see it because I think I don't, and I can completely understand that train of thought. But we've come on so far in how we talk about so many subjects that actually, you're right. Now, something that was very kind and generous and well-intentioned now has a slightly different meaning and interpretation.
Yes, exactly. And I think you hit the nail right on the head. Our language and our thinking around disability is evolving. Like, for example, the concept of ableism didn't exist when I was a kid. I mean, and we didn't even really talk about disability discrimination. You just, you know, it wasn't in the language. So it is, you know, and if you look at the media landscape as well, you have high profile disabled figures in the media like Rosie Jones and Alex Booker, and you have the Paralympics and disability sport is much higher profile. So things are changing slowly, but they are changing.
Did you ever, when you were younger, did you ever say, I am disabled? Or was it something that you didn't want to own? And how has your vocabulary around how you describe yourself changed as you've come to terms with who you are and what your place is?
Oh, that's a good question. I found it very difficult to say I am disabled. I remember actually, and I write about this in the book, I remember actually saying to myself that I was gay, and I found that easier to say than I did to say I am disabled, which is really weird because my disability is a very profound, visible difference. I walk with crutches. You know, obviously it's one of the first things, if not the first thing, that anybody will notice about me. So I was much easier with denying it, even though it was such a profound difference, than I was about denying my sexuality. My sexuality to me was a lot easier to accommodate than my physical difference. And I don't really know why that is. But I think it was just something I didn't want so much. And that now that I'm in a different place, that feels really sad to me that I spent such a long time rejecting something that is intrinsic to my body and myself and my sense of self. You know, it feels like a real wasted time.
I suppose that makes my mind jump back to what you said about the coverage of you and the operation back when you were 12, and that I could completely understand why there would be a reluctance to own that about yourself and to accept it when you were the boy who was going to overcome it, who was going to be disabled when they went under anesthetic and would come out not disabled essentially, which is what was spun. I know that's not what the doctors told you, but that was what was spun. And as a 12-year-old, I can completely understand if you would have believed every single word that you read and hoped that it would be true.
Oh, I hoped so much, Emma. I hoped so much. I remember my grandmother was staying with us when the bandages and the cast came off, and I had a bath because obviously I hadn't been able to have a proper bath for a really long time. And they left me on my own just to get used to just to see my legs and to get used to how they felt. And I remember, and I write about this too, I remember looking in the bath and just thinking, this is not going to be what I thought it was going to be. This is just not going to be. I just, in that moment, I just thought, I say in the book, you know, I would still be walking on my hands. I might have changed, but I'd still be balancing on my hands. And it was a profound grief, to be perfectly honest. And again, I can blame nobody for that because it was it had been what I had interpreted. But I remember just looking at my legs and thinking, they've changed, but they haven't changed that much. And they haven't changed, you know, in the way that I need them to. So that was really, really difficult.
Were you able to communicate that at the time?
No. I went very inward. I went very inward. And also I was very, very dependent on my family for my physical care. So I didn't want to upset them. I was very aware that they were working very hard to look after me. You know, my parents were both out of work, earning a living. My grandmother and them, I couldn't upset them because they were looking after me, and also I loved them very much. I didn't want to upset them more than I was already.
That's a huge emotional burden for a child to bear, because you're having your own experience and you're also being extremely mindful of the people around you. That's a real burden, Emma.
It didn't feel like one at the time because, as you say, I was very young, and it just was kind of natural behavior to me then, looking after other people and kind of looking after their feelings around what I was going through. But looking back on it, I can see that it was a huge thing to undertake, really. It's difficult.
I'm curious as well about how you would describe now, with the many years of hindsight that you have, how you would describe fame and what it was like to go from relative obscurity to being on the cover of newspapers and magazines, to be the subject of television programs, and not just in local press, but in national press and international press, and the impact that had on you, and how you feel about that kind of thing generally now, having gone through it at such a strange time.
It's really strange because I was in my early 20s when things like Pop Idol were at their height, and it seemed like everybody wanted to be famous. And again, you know, fame seems to be the goal now. It's not about being good at something or being celebrated for being a good writer or a good journalist or a good, people just want to be famous. And I think as a culture, that's kind of where we still are. You know, everyone can be famous now. It's been democratized by Instagram, by, you know, the media landscape we're in has really changed. And I find it so bizarre. You know, I want to be known as a good writer. That's my hope, that people like the book and they respond to it. I don't want to be famous. I don't understand why anybody would want to be famous. I think anonymity is so precious. And you only, a lot of celebrities have spoken about this. You only realize how precious anonymity is when you don't have it anymore, when it's too late. So yeah, I think fame is incredibly, yeah, it's a false god, it's a false idol, I think, definitely.
It's interesting as well what you say about anonymity, because you only realize how precious it is once it's gone. And yet, how many celebrities get their anonymity back and it's tarnished?
And they don't necessarily, yeah, they have a very ambivalent relationship to their fame. They don't really want to be famous, but they don't want to be anonymous either. So they're in this kind of bizarre hinterland where it's like, yeah, it's difficult.
You said hinterland. I was thinking like cling film. Like cling film is great, but if you stretch it too far, you can't unstretch it. And
It's
it's like
true.
that. Fame is like that once
That's
it's
a really good
stretched.
image. That's a really good
The tensile strength of cling film is
Yeah,
basically what fame is perched on. Okay,
exactly.
so I think we've got a really good sense of your relationship with risk, and also the fact that you took a huge risk at the age of 12 and have really thought about that quite in depth over the years. But I'm curious about excuses that you have used or that you have made for others in your life. And actually, I thought this was really revealing because you said actually it has to do with your relationship with money. And I'm so glad that you said this, because I think this is the kind of thing that This is the kind of thing that people keep in the dark.
I thought very hard when I was answering your questions prior to coming on. I thought very hard about whether I wanted to reveal this because, as you say, it's a big taboo, isn't it? But I've been in the creative industries most of my life, and I would say that psychotherapy is more of an art than a science. So I would class it as a part of the creative industries in a way. And historically, they're quite low paid. And I have always had, I mean, I've always really enjoyed it. And it's a privilege to have done what I've done. And I really, but because of my disability, my relationship with my disability and money are intimately linked. I've always used money as a compensatory mechanism. And it used to drive my parents bananas because I used to go, I can't walk, you know, if I want that jacket, I'm going to have it. Or if I want to go on this holiday, I'm going to have it. And I was quite a, yeah, it was quite difficult for them because they come from quite frugal backgrounds, quite, you know, they're quite, they always have to get value for money. And I had none of that concern. And also, this is probably getting a bit profound, but it's the truth. I was in when I was in the disabled school, and I write about this in the book. A lot of the pupils that I was at school with died quite early on. So at a time when most people are feeling invulnerable and immortal as teenagers, I really understood and internalized the fact that life is short. The fact that life is really short and really fleeting. So that gave me, for want of a better word, a very hedonistic mindset of like, if I want to do something today, I'm going to do it. But that led to, yeah, kind of very, very difficult situations around money. And I've worked through it and I've resolved it, but it's still a psychological tender spot for me, I think.
Did being around children who were dying, did well, I'm assuming that it just made you look at your own mortality, and maybe again, you perhaps didn't say it out loud at the time, and perhaps didn't even know necessarily in your head, but you, I guess, it's like that thing, isn't it, when you're waiting to go and have a test and you see the person, and like my surname begins with G, so like you're waiting for the B's and C's and D's to go in, you know your turn's coming. Did it feel like, in a really morbid way, did it feel like that a bit? So it's like, so I'm going to live in the short term.
Absolutely, absolutely. You couldn't have hit the nail more squarely on the head. I just thought, well, given that I know absolutely that life is short, no, I'm going to enjoy it as much as I can. The flip side of that situation is that I take a great deal of pleasure in life. I've learned how to enjoy the things that I enjoy really profoundly. But yeah, I just, you know, for a lot of people, even my friends, I mean, I'm in midlife now, and, you know, my friends are the same age, obviously, but you can tell by the way they talk about it that death is still something that happens to everyone else, not them. Death is still something that's not ever, you know, it's over in a room somewhere. But me, unfortunately, because of the situation I went through as a teenager, I haven't been able to avoid it. So, but the flip side of that is I do have quite an enjoyable short-term kind of approach to life.
And it hasn't, you said that you've sort of overcome the issues with money. I'm sure there were a lot of people listening going off, for crying out loud, Emma, ask him how. How did he create more of an equilibrium around his spending and his, the way that he spent money? Because I think a lot of us, maybe not all the time, but there will be those days where you just buy something, you don't really think it through, but it's meeting a need. It's not because of what you're actually buying.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I don't go to a 12-step program, but it's something I borrowed from a 12-step program, Debtors Anonymous, which is where they tell you how to do a daily spending log. So you write, and at first I found it, and I don't do it anymore, but I found it a real bind, because for the first few months that you do it, you have to write down absolutely every single thing that you buy. So like a stick of gum, a coffee, whatever you have. But what I learned looking back over it, over the 3 or 4 months that I did it, was that I would routinely underestimate what things cost, or I would round them down, you know. So actually, you know, it was very, I could see where my overspending was, you know. So it was quite mortifying to see it in black and white. Like, it was quite upsetting. So in a sense, holding yourself to account helps you to correct your behavior, because you realize that you're just routinely deluding yourself. Oh no, I didn't do that, or I sent that clothing back when you didn't, you know, you left it in the bottom of the wardrobe. So it was kind of mortifying, but very useful.
It's analysis, isn't it? It's collecting your data and being honest, because there's one thing to collect your data, but you also have to be really honest with what you're inputting.
Yes, you can't kid yourself, otherwise it doesn't work.
You can't, I mean, I've talked openly on this podcast about really struggling with my weight, and I have a real problem with that phrase anyway, because I didn't struggle with my weight, truthfully. I had an issue with overeating. And the effect on my body of that was that I would gain weight that I didn't want. But it took me a very, very long time to piece together, to be accountable for the behavior that led to the results. I put so many excuses between this thing that happened over here at mealtime and this thing that happened over here when I got on the scales. And the only way I was able to confront it and overcome it, a bit like you with money, was to analyze it, be honest and be accountable, and realize, which is what I was ignoring or in denial about, my actions had a direct impact on the outcome. And so
this helps you to see the trigger, doesn't it?
100%.
And you, in your case, did you see that it had an emotional trigger, your relationship with food, or that you would use it in a particular way?
Sometimes there was an emotional trigger. But I don't, again, it's one of those things that I've looked at enough to be able to see it coming, but I haven't looked at it forensically to go, okay, it comes from that particular whatever. But
it's one of those things, isn't it, that it is, you know, it's a continuous thing. It's not ever resolved, you know, fully. It's something that you have to monitor kind of going forwards all the time, isn't it?
100%. So, well, I think actually it's quite good sometimes, like if there's ever a quote unquote bad day, I actually now really appreciate them, because what I appreciate about a bad day is I know that all it will take to recover, again, in inverted commas, is one day. Because I've done the work, I've done the analysis, I know what normal should feel like. And so I can come back to it really quickly. Whereas years ago, a bad day would have led to 3, 4, 5, 6 months, possibly even a year plus of just freewheeling.
Yeah. And you just sort of go, well, you haven't got the tools in place to take you back to that binge, or that pre-binge state. But now you've got the learning, and you've also got, you know that you can be different. You know that you can behave in a different way. So you've got the choice.
So do you, is that the same with you for money? Do you feel like every now and again you'll spend something and you'll think, oh, work?
Very much so. I don't want to sit there and pretend to your listeners that I've got it licked, because I haven't, you know. And actually, it's really funny. When I was doing clinical work, I'm not at the moment, but when I was seeing clients, very often in your first sessions, you could see that they would project onto you as the therapist the idea that you somehow had it all figured out. And I just wanted to say, I didn't, because it's not very professional, but I just wanted to say, like, I'm in the same boat as you are. You know, I'm learning in the same way that you are. There's no hierarchy here. I'm not a guru. I'm just here to listen and to pay attention and to, you know, to try and offer, I can offer my attention and my compassion, but I haven't in any way figured this out. You know, I'm not a guru at all.
I think that's really interesting. I was chatting to Jodi Karras from The Self Space recently, and I said that I think sometimes when it comes to therapists, you assume that their mental health, this abstract, their brain, whatever, is they're able to do the work that they do. Because if you were to take their mental health and turn it into a physical thing, a gentleman in tails would walk into the room and it would be on a silver tray under a cloche. And it would sort of, there'd be a low, very resonant hum coming from it, and it would be pure and untouched, like
I perfect diamonds. I love that image.
And that's why therapists are equipped to be the person giving therapy, because their mental health is intact and perfect and has never been tinged by depression or anxiety or any of these things. It's not that.
Yeah. And actually, I think very often therapists go into being therapists because they've had their own profound challenges in that way. And that's what sparked their interest. And that's what made them want to train. So actually, I think my vulnerability was my strength as a therapist. I really do. I mean, obviously, as a therapist, it's not about you, it's about the client. So you don't talk about yourself. But I was very open to the fact that, you know, it's obvious when you see me physically that I've had struggles and that the world has sometimes dealt with me unfairly. So, you know, I'm starting from a place of vulnerability. So I hope that helped my clients to be able to be more open with me.
How do you feel the world has treated you? And I ask you this because a friend of mine's husband is in a wheelchair, and she was explaining the eye contact thing, how people won't look, people will pretend they haven't seen you, eye contact can sometimes, they might be talking to you, but they might talk to her, but not her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a whole layer that you wouldn't know about unless you knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you about for listeners and for me as well is, what can we do to break those barriers down, if you like, and to make everybody feel welcome, even if they have physical challenges that we don't acknowledge? And again, I was walking through Green Park the other day and there was a gentleman walking towards me and he was blind. And people were just, you know what London's like at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to flank him and get him onto Piccadilly, because I can't imagine what it must be like not being able to see, hearing the sights and sounds of London, and also knowing that someone's probably on their phone and might barge into you at any moment because they're not looking up.
Mm-mm. It's a really good question. It's something I've thought about a lot, because obviously, you know, as I age, I may transition into a wheelchair myself. And one of the reasons why I wanted to have the surgery was my consultants at the time were saying, when this child gets their adult body mass, they will be pulled off their feet into a wheelchair. Now, obviously, life in a wheelchair is not bad at all. But, you know, it was something at that age I didn't want. And I think what you were saying about your friend and the way he's treated, I was really frightened about not having a space, not being looked at, not being regarded. And I do find that because I'm able to stand, people look at me, people perceive me in a very different way. I'm not ignored in mm-hmm. the way that you are when you're disabled, because I'm there in someone's eye line. I'm not. But as to what we do, that's a bit more of a difficult question, because I think there are so many structural inequalities for disabled people still. And there's so much uneasiness around disabled people in the world. And there are, like you were explaining, well, like you were talking about in your previous response, you know, there's so much conscious and unconscious prejudice towards the disabled, and the built environment is still so difficult to navigate. Like, for example, I can't use the tube, I have to get cabs everywhere, I can't, you know, so there, I don't think there's any easy answer. I would say that the best way, if you're encountering someone with a disability, is just openness to it and ask questions. If there's something you don't know or is making you feel uncomfortable, ask them. Mm. Ask them. Like, it's like with someone's pronouns now. Mm. Ask them how they want to be addressed. Ask them what you can do. You know, just try not to be embarrassed. Try not to be wrong-footed by it. And just be open and approachable. And I always really like it when I had a friend of mine, her son is about 9 or 10, and he was asking me what was wrong with me. And his parents were really embarrassed. But I really liked being able to tell him. And obviously, I simplified my language and I made it an exchange that he could understand. But I really liked, I really appreciated him asking me, because then you can start to have a conversation.
Well, because it sounds like oftentimes it's people will see it but won't say it.
Yes, exactly. And as you were saying about the blind man in Green Park, people just scatter to avoid. They just don't want to be. Oftentimes their anxiety means they don't want to be anywhere near it. So their way of dealing with the problem is just to pretend that it doesn't exist, or, you know, rather than addressing that person. And as you were saying, asking them if they needed assistance, or, you know, it really is quite simple. Just ask.
Yeah. What's the best way that I can help?
Mm, exactly.
Okay, well, that's good advice to share. We talk about obstacles on this podcast, and your answer to this one was very robust. It was quite a long answer, because it isn't just about the physical obstacles. There have been emotional ones too. So I don't know what you necessarily want to pick on specifically, but I was really interested about the idea of disability and sexuality, and how those two fundamental things about you that make you, in air quotes, different, have been obstacles that you've had to overcome, not just in the discussions that we've had so far, not just for you, but actually for other people.
it's been a huge, it's kind of been the defining challenge of my life, that intersectional identity. I remember when I was coming out to my mum, which was a surprise to absolutely nobody, and my parents were wonderful about it. You know, my mum was fantastic. But I remember saying I was really, really upset, finally acknowledging that this thing was not going to pass. It wasn't a passing phase. This was me. This is who I was. And I said to her, like, how am I going to do it? How am I going to do this? Like, I can be one or the other thing, but not both. I can do, you know, I can have one thing, one challenge, because I didn't see anybody in the media who looked like me. I didn't see anybody who walked like me. And in my images of gay culture, there was just nobody who looked like me. So I was really frightened that I was going to be on my own, and that I wasn't going to get to it, that my sexuality would always remain theoretical, and that I would all, so what did it matter really if I called myself gay or because I thought I wasn't ever going to get the chance to express it. And I think, to be quite honest, I think things haven't changed as much as they need to. I think there's a real ambivalence towards disabled people expressing any kind of sexuality, let alone homosexuality. I mean, it's really, yeah, I think it's really problematic for a lot of people. And a writer who I was speaking to at an event a year or so ago, who I won't name, asked me what I was writing, and they said, oh yeah, you don't think about disabled people having sex, do you? And I was like, well, I do, because it's my life, you know. Clearly it's not the only thing I do. I've been married for a long time, so it's kind of not the highest priority any longer, but it's a huge part of my identity. It's an innate part of myself, as it is for everyone. And if you deny your sexuality, you're denying a part of your humanity. So all I want is the chance to express that. And one of the things I say in the book is that the thing I wanted the most was simply to be seen by society for who I was. And it's just, I think we've got an awful long way to go. And I think actually the age of Instagram and the rise of social media have made things more complicated, because there's a real focus on physical perfection in a way that maybe there wasn't before. Maybe I'm naive, maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like with all the filtering of reality and everyone presenting a very curated, perfect image of themselves, it feels like, a particular moment.
I think it depends culture. Where you go on Instagram. I think you're absolutely right. And I think the social media platforms do definitely favour perfection. And look, as a 45-year-old woman who does makeup videos on Instagram and doesn't have any issue going online without makeup on, I don't use any kind of filters, because to be honest, Emma, I don't know quite how. And there are other things I need to learn how to do.
Exactly.
So for me, I'm like, well, that's not what I engage with. But I think for younger people, absolutely, you're right. This idea of perfectionism is actually dangerous. But then on the other side of it, I think for every account that is showing perfect abs, a six pack or a tiny waist or a Brazilian butt lift, or not Brazilian butt lift, but you know, like a booty, that's meant to be perfect, there's somebody else in a bikini showing stretch marks, or there's somebody else showing what a bigger body looks like in a bikini. Yeah. And so actually it does seem to be a bit more democratic, but it's the algorithm, I think, that's the problem, because it's what you look at, it's going to show you more of.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to get those things reinforced to yourself. And I think you're right, Emma. I think, you know, there is a greater movement towards body positivity, which is fantastic. And I'm so glad to be around in a time when that's part of the conversation. But I think when you're talking about gay culture, I think it's slightly different. I think we have a lot of a longer way to go. I don't want to punch down on my community at all, but my experience as a disabled gay man has been, very difficult, and at times quite lonely, because my mum said to me, driving back to school when I come out to her, she said, "I'm just so worried for you, Emmett, because I want you to find love. I want you to find a fulfilling life." And from what I've seen of the gay community, it really emphasizes and fetishizes almost physical perfection. And quite clearly, I wasn't that. So I'm very lucky. You know, I've found my tribe and I'm married. But for a long time, it didn't feel like there was a place for me.
And it's interesting, in a defense of that writer who said that to you, it's a little bit like the comment of, "I don't see you like that." That's something that was said a year ago, but in 10 years' time, the vocabulary will have changed, and the understanding will have changed, because you're absolutely right. These things are still happening in the dark, for want of a better expression. We might be seeing lots more body types, and we might be more inclusive, we might be more accepting, but you're absolutely right, there are still certain things that just, they're not just not talked about, they're not seen. And I think in a visual world, if you're not seeing it, you would, so your knee-jerk reaction was, "Oh yeah, you wouldn't know that happened."
And as you say, it wasn't meant maliciously at all. It was really well-meaning and it was curious. But I was just really interested, because I was like, well, I do, because it's my lived experience. You know, it's my everyday.
Yeah. So. And when I asked you about your greatest success, it does come back to that, about being out and being very happily gay and married.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking to a friend yesterday, and I'm not sure how this came out, but I mean, apart from having written a book, my life is so ordinary now. And I mean that in the best sense. You know, it's the kind of ordinary I really cherish, and I never could have imagined. As a very scared and lonely queer teenager, I never imagined that I would ever get to the point where, you know, my life was just blissfully ordinary. It really feels like a privilege to have got here.
What does blissfully ordinary mean, though?
Well, it means having people you love, having a job that you love, having a relationship that I never thought I would have access to. You know, I love the person I married. It's a good job that I love the person I married, but I love the person I married. I have a really good life, and it's the kind of life I couldn't have even envisaged, you know, as in the times that I write about in the book. You know, I was so lonely and I was so filled with self-loathing and internalized ableism. And I know you've spoken about eating disorders on here, but I write about having quite a significant eating disorder myself for a period of time, because I didn't know how to express quite how unhappy I was feeling. And the only way I felt like I could do it was to take my emotional frustration out on my body. You know, I wanted to punish myself. I knew I wasn't fat, but I wanted to punish myself. I wanted to damage myself. And so to have come from that terribly, terribly low point to sort of having a lovely life, I feel that's really successful.
I think there's something to be said for, and I'm going to pull this together really clumsily because I haven't really articulated this before, but, and I think the smoothest way is to talk about myself, which I don't like doing on the podcast, but bear with me.
Of course.
I think one of the reasons why I struggled with my mental health for a long time and sort of hit the depths that I did is because I always, deep down, I believed things could be different. Mm-hmm. My frustration and the way it all came out in the ways that it did, well, because I didn't know how, and I hadn't put two and two together that actually I could make things different. I weirdly thought that it would happen. And when I saw other people having good lives, I thought it just happened to them. They were lucky. I hadn't put together. So I think listening to what you're saying, you hear all of these things about what your life might be like. You have these doctor's appointments as a kid. When he reaches his adult weight, he'll be pulled off his feet. I mean, that's a really intense thing to hear as a child. And I'm sure there are a catalogue of things like that that you must have heard, all of which would have attached themselves to you physically as a weight, sort of like, you can't have this. Absolutely. Won't happen. And maybe, but there's obviously something about you, Emmett, whereby you want to defy the odds. You want it to not be true because
yes, absolutely.
You never accepted it. And I think sometimes those tumultuous, see, I told you it's going to be clumsy. I think sometimes the really tumultuous mental health issues that people go through are resisting what we're told it should be and fighting for what we want it to be.
It's like the we all internalize narratives about what success looks like.
Mm.
That you do have agency. You do. It can often feel like you don't have any agency. Mm. And as a teenager, I really felt like I didn't have any agency. But I do have a certain amount of power over the choices I make, and I do have, you know, ways to navigate things.
Yeah. One of my funnest questions to ask my guests is to tell me about a time when you were wrong. And Emmett, having spoken to you, I don't believe that you ever have been, but go on.
Oh,
you said that your partner would have a list.
so many. Let's think.
You said to me that where I've been most wrong is all of the frightened, closeted years I spent believing that a life like mine would be impossible, and that you felt like you wasted so much time and spent a lot of energy hating.
That's exactly it. I think where I was wrong, and I think, again, this was more of a product of my environment and the culture that I was grown up in. I believed that my body was wrong. I believed all the messages that I was given that my body was wrong and that I was somehow to blame for it. You know, kind of disability is, well, not now, but it was framed sort of as a moral failing. And the language the doctors used is the medical model of disability talks about fixing. So you internalize this idea that everyone else is perfect, so therefore you're imperfect and you need to be fixed. And I'm now realizing that there's no such thing as perfect. Nobody's perfect. Disabled or able-bodied, nobody's perfect. And as we've talked about previously, perfection is kind of a false god, and it's always moving. You know, it's always somewhere else. So I really feel for the person that I was. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was for the person that I had been, kind of for him, because I wasted so much time caring what other people thought, hating myself with furious energy, and actually making myself really, really unwell in the process. So I really feel that I, you know, and seeing people, you know, in the public eye now, disabled people like wonderful, wonderful Rosie Jones, who just has such a brilliant, who's also gay, you know, she's a lesbian woman who's also disabled. And she has such a different attitude to the attitude that I had. You know, her attitude is, my disability is an intrinsic and wonderful part of who I am. And if I'd had somebody like that to look at when I was growing up, I may have got here a bit sooner, because she's such an inspiration to me and such, you know, she's just out there living her life. And she gets an enormous amount of abuse, sadly, because she's in the public eye, but she's still doing it. She's still out there. She's saying, you know, my disability is an intrinsic part of who I am. It's not a problem, you know. And
before you mention Rosie, the way that you were describing the situation was reminding me, there's a brilliant scene in, it was the Will and Grace reboot. I don't know if you watched it.
I did.
Where essentially Will, I mean, I'm a 45-year-old woman, so when I was growing up, the storyline about somebody coming out in a TV show, whether it was a drama or a comedy, it was a big deal. It was tackled very sensitively because it was still quite taboo back then. And there's this great scene where he's chatting to a younger gay man, and he was like, "What's your coming out story?" And he's like, "Oh, my parents threw me a party." And it's just how things have changed so much.
Yeah.
And I think you obviously were on the kind of, you were graded on a curve, if you like. And because of you, your experience, and because of you telling your story, you're inevitably going to make it easier for somebody next, somebody younger. Yeah.
That's my hope. That really is my hope. There's a wonderful quote from Toni Morrison, the writer, where she says, "If you can't find the book that you want to read, then you must be the one to write it." And that was really my inspiration for writing the book. I thought, well, what was the book that I would have needed and would have wanted to read as a frightened, queer, disabled teenager? And it's really the book that I've written. So I hope that it does help, and I hope that it moves the conversation on a bit.
Does somebody need to be queer and or disabled to read it and to take value from it?
No, absolutely not. I think really my hope is that it's a more universal story as well. It's a story of a family. It's about love. It's about friendship. It's quite funny, I hope. And it's also about kind of our universal need to belong. Because whatever we call ourselves, whatever label we're most comfortable with, we all want to connect to one another in whatever that looks like, in whatever way. You know, some people are asexual, some people don't have, you know, they don't have the goals that I have. They don't want to get married. They don't want to do those things, and that's fine. But the common experience is, I think, that we all want to connect. Mm. We all want to matter. So yeah, the story is about that more than it's about my personal identities.
Before I let you go, I'm going to ask you, what is it that makes you feel hopeful about the future?
Oh, I remember what I wrote for this one. And this is where I get a little bit emotional. It's my stepsons, really, because they're people I never expected to have in my life. You know, I never expected to have children. And I just, you know, they're wonderful young men. They're really, really interesting, ethical, politically engaged, caring. You know, that gives me hope. Sometimes it feels at the moment like hope is a bit of a radical act, but we all have to have hope, you know. And more generally, I think the younger generation do give me hope. When you look at, you know, things like the climate activism movement and the younger generation holding our politicians to account and being much more alert and awake than I was, because the stakes are really high at the moment. So that gives me hope that people, you know, care.
It's funny because I think they get a really hard time. It's either they are the future, they are going to make all the important changes, or it's that, oh, they're so rude and slovenly and they're always stuck on their phones. You can't, there's nowhere in between. Yeah. I feel so bad for them.
Me too. Because as you say, it seems to be a really polarizing thing, doesn't it? It's either, you know, you can't buy a house because you eat too much avocado toast. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And they're under enormous pressure.
Yeah,
in a way that maybe I wasn't. So,
well, it was so lovely to chat to you. They sound fine young men.
It was such a pleasure.
It was so nice to connect. And thank you for sharing your story so honestly and for being so, just being honest. I think this felt like a very real conversation, and I really, really appreciate that from my guest. Thank you.
Thank you. It really was a delight. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you so much for listening to that episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I do hope you enjoyed it. I appreciate your time hugely. If you did enjoy it and you never want to miss an episode, then please do hit the subscribe button wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. It's also where you get the opportunity to leave a 5-star review and a rating for how you feel about the show. And I'd be so grateful if you wouldn't mind leaving one. If you want to get in touch with me, email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Or you can DM me on Instagram and Twitter, where I am at Emma Guns. If you fancy chatting to me and thousands of other fellow listeners of the podcast, then click the link to join the Facebook forum. The link to join is in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. You have to answer a couple of questions, but we cannot wait to see you there. Come over and join the conversation. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you on the next one.